All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Marden Guitars. Marden Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Hey everybody, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the founder and publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that's John Rauhouse playing in the background. Before we get into it, just a quick note. I know 2020 has been pretty much the most challenging year any of us have ever had to go through. I have seen so many great small businesses and restaurants and venues. Yes, even magazines go under recently. And I just want to let everybody know the Fretboard Journal is not immune to those same pressures. We are a very small business doing the best we can during a very troubling time. I saw my favorite magazine of my childhood, Powder Magazine, a ski magazine that was basically my Bible, made me want to become a journalist, made me want to start the Fretboard Journal. It just went under a week ago, and it really hit me hard. We are doing the best we can, but we could always use your support. So if you love these interviews, and we've had a string of incredible interviews, not only on this podcast, but in the magazine recently, if it's meaningful to you that we do these sort of in-depth, exhaustive conversations with music heroes and folks that you just simply aren't going to read about or hear about anywhere else, we'd love your support. You can subscribe to our magazine. That is the easiest way to support the show. I'll include a link in the show notes. It's $44 for a year of quarterly keepsake issues. Or maybe you don't like paper goods. Maybe you're minimalist. Maybe you're not even really a magazine person. You just want to show your support for all that we do. We also now have PDF digital subscriptions. It's just $30 US, no matter where in the world you are. And you will get 4 PDFs delivered to your inbox. And it's a great way to support all that we do. We have employees, we have contractors, we have so many helpers, and they all need to be paid. And all of those people allow me to do this podcast and all the fun things that I do and share with you. And so I'd really appreciate your support. Obviously, if there are any brands out there or bigger companies that want to talk about advertising, either here or in the magazine, reach out to me, jason@fretboardjournal.com. I am all ears. This is our 15th anniversary year. I want to be around for the next 15 years and then some. And I want to keep sharing these stories and keep embracing this amazing community that we've built up. Speaking of community, today's guest is one of my dear friends. I love this guy. He is also probably the most reluctant Fretboard Journal podcast guest we've had in recent memory. Steve McCreary is the general manager of Collings Guitars and Mandolins. I've known this guy for years, pretty much since the Fretboard Journal started 15 years ago. I see him a few times a year at guitar shows or at the Collings factory. Collings are some of my personal favorite instruments being made today. They are so playable and so beautiful and just so tastefully done. They've never released a gaudy guitar that I can tell. They just totally fit my aesthetic, and they fit the aesthetic of the magazine, I think, really well, as you will hear about later in our chat. But I've known Steve all these years, and Steve is the guy who is quick to point out all the people who work with him before he gives himself any credit. And so we've obviously interviewed Bill Collings, the founder, the amazing, outspoken, hilarious, unfiltered Bill Collings. He passed away a few years ago. He was on this podcast. We've interviewed Bruce Van Wart, longtime Collings employee, amazing person. But when it came for me to say to Steve, hey, you should be on this podcast because I know you, you're my friend, and I don't even know your story, he didn't really want to do it. But I convinced him, and that's what you're going to hear. And I think it was worth the wait for me. I learned a lot. I had a blast talking to him. It fits one more piece of the puzzle of how they're able to make such cool instruments day in and day out. Collings obviously now makes acoustic guitars and electrics. They were making ukes, they were making cases, they've got their whole Waterloo line. I'll include links in the show notes, but please, if you somehow are listening to this podcast and have been enjoying it but don't know what a Collings instrument is, go look them up. But I have a feeling everybody listening to this podcast knows all too well what Collings are like, and you probably love them. Before we get to the interview, shout out to our two sponsors, Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags and pedal board bags, studio monitor stands. Everything that they do is so well built. I love my Mono Vertigo case, and if you have an electric guitar, I think you will too. And our other sponsors are friends over in New York at Retrofret Vintage Guitars, who happen to have right now a 2002 Collings MF5 Red Spruce Top Mandolin, speaking of Collings, that was signed by Bill himself, and a lot more. A 63 Esquire, a 1967 Ampeg AUB fretless bass. I didn't even know this thing existed. Amazing. Everything. Every time I go to the Retrofret site and read a description, I learn something new about instruments, and I think you will too. So go to retrofret.com. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Last but not least, it's our 15th year of publishing. Like I said, I want to be around for 15 more years. Everything that we've done, every story that we've shared, every interview that we've released, either in the magazine or on this podcast, is all about discovery. It's what drives me to do this thing every day. It's what hopefully drives you to listening to me every week. It's what made us start the Luthier and Luthier podcast, as well as the runaway hit of 2020, the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast. And I want folks to start sharing some of your Fretboard Journal discoveries. So hashtag Fretboard15, Fretboard15 is the way to do it. And I would love to see, during these depressing times when I basically don't even want to be on Facebook or Instagram anymore, I'd love to see some of your stories about one thing, just one thing, that the Fretboard Journal turned you on to that maybe changed your life or your guitar quiver or how you perceived music. It could be a quote. It could be one of our videos. It could be a musician you had no idea existed that changed your listening habits. You can also, because I want to make a podcast out of these as well, send me a voice memo at, I'm just Jason at fretboardjournal.com. I'll compile a bunch of these and we'll make it a show later in the year. But all year long, we're going to be celebrating Fretboard 15, and I'd love for you to be a part of it. I have a feeling everyone who's been listening to this show has been turned on to somebody they had no idea existed, because let's be honest, I like the eclectic stuff. I like discovering people alongside you. So anyways, that is my spiel. I hope folks will participate. I hope you will all subscribe. I'll include a link in the show notes. And once again, my dear friend, Steve McCreary of Collings Guitars, despite his better judgment, is our guest on this week's podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. Steve McCreary, you are the most reluctant guest I've ever had on the podcast. You have graciously let others, we've talked to Aaron, we've talked to Bruce, we've talked to Alex, and of course we've talked to Bill, but whenever I've asked you to be on this or at an event, you always are the first to offer up the rest of your staff, which is amazing. But I want to know your story, which is why I finally pinned you down to this. Before we get to all that, though, how are you doing? You got hurt.
Oh, hey, I did have shoulder surgery. Actually, I hurt myself, but that's doing well. I've been on the floor this morning doing my physical therapy, which is, you know, self-induced torture. But the goal is to get back to doing the stuff I like doing and was doing before this injury. But thanks for asking. I'm doing fine.
And you injured yourself not doing anything like hang gliding, but just goofing off in the backyard?
Exercising.
Okay. That out of the way.
we'll leave it at that. I'm a very active guy. I like doing stuff. I do a lot of stuff outdoors. You know, tree work is my hobby and all. But I just, I was kind of getting back into doing a little exercising and I overdid it, and I'll leave it at just being stupid.
Okay.
Leave it at that.
Now, before we should talk guitars, and we will, but tree work as a hobby, have you studied how to be an arborist, or you just love working on trees?
Well, No, I never studied that. But I have a few acres, or, you know, 4 acres, and lots of trees, and I have to thin them out. And I've been doing it for over 20 years since we've been out here. And they, you know, grow all over each other and need to be trimmed so they can get to sunlight. And with our water situation here, they're all competing for that, you know, moisture in the soil. So I clear trees every year and cut down lots and lots of trees and trim trees. And I like sawing them up. I like climbing up on ladders with chainsaws and almost bonsaiing, you know, larger trees than are normally bonsai. It's really fun. I really like it. It's a nice, release, and but requires a lot of shoulder work. Yeah. So I can't do that stuff right now. There are a couple of times a year here where we can do it because of what's called live oak decline. It's this tree wilt that affects the live oak trees here, which is the main tree in Central Texas. They're beautiful, you know, trees, and some get to be very old, but they get this spore and they die, and you see it all over the place, these dead oak trees. And so to avoid that, I like to trim in the right times of year and, you know, paint the pruning areas and stuff. So anyway, it's just a fun thing. I like doing it.
Wow. Does this wood, is it usable for anything that you cut off?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's all firewood. We have a fireplace, but there's no gas in the house. So all the fires are started with kindling and paper. And my wife works from home and likes fires almost every day in the wintertime. So we go through lots and lots of wood. So I have lots of piles of wood around the place.
All right. That's a fretboard journal first. I don't know anyone who likes climbing in trees just for the heck of it. But it sounds warranted. It sounds like fun.
Yeah, it is. Both of the above.
Are you a chainsaw snob?
Well, I have a couple of steel saws, yes. Okay. I've had all kinds of stuff, but I like these. I like steel chainsaws.
Do you modify them and, like, take them out of stock to meet your needs?
No, I'm not.
Just checking.
I'm not very mechanical, so no. As long as they start and run, and I, you know, and I change blades frequently, that suits my needs. I don't have, like, you know, 3 foot bars or anything. These are 18 inch bars. They work just fine for what I rent log splitters, you know, every year and split up the stuff that's too big for, I don't try hand splitting stuff anymore. That's a little bit, the gas powered splitter is way, way more fun.
Got it. Well, now that we've, done that interview for the Chainsaw Journal, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Tyler, Texas, which is about 90 miles east of Dallas, just, you know, along I-20, but south of I-20, 15 miles or so, 90 miles east of Dallas.
All right. And what was your childhood like? Were you into music at an early age or into other stuff?
Well, the music part, yeah, I mean, like, a lot of people, you know, my mom sang a lot and sang in the church choir, which of course we did as kids. And then she even actually did some jingles and stuff, you know, later on in life. And so she's always been a singer and still does sing it. She'll be 92 in less than 2 months.
Wow.
So singer, you know, there was some music in the house, but not like my parents weren't, super music fans in the house. I mean, the record collection was at that time was Andy Williams and Perry Como and the Letterman and, you know, stuff, things that didn't necessarily appeal
yeah
to me. But as a kid, I didn't really, you know, pay that much attention to it. I was really young, but, you know, later on teenage years, music became very important to me and my friends.
Did you play guitar in high school? Or
I did. I mean, I got a guitar as a kid. I think I got this electric guitar and I was 10 years old. It was a Crown, mm-hmm. which I think was a Japanese model, a Crown guitar and amp. And, so I had guitars since an early age, but I was never a natural guitar player. But during high school, me and my buddies would play all the popular stuff, you know, the Neil Young songs and Crosby, Stills and Nash and the things that were, you know, popular then. And that, Willis Allen Ramsey songs. I still play some of the same stuff 50 years later.
Yeah, that's kind of how we
but
all
not
are.
Not much more than that. Yeah, <I know. laughs> not much more than this stuff from 50 years ago.
And what was your move out of out of the house for college?
I moved down to Austin. So in the early 70s, I had friends that had siblings or cousins or down going to school at the University of Texas in Austin. So we would come down to Austin even before we were out of high school, just for weekends and to just partake of everything that wasn't in East Texas, which, of course, down here was lots and lots of music. College campus, tens of thousands of young people, go to the Armadillo World Headquarters where you could see Bruce Springsteen or The Police or Frank Zappa or Taj Mahal for $2 and stuff. So it was a really fun stuff to do down here, and not so much of that back home. So I always liked it down here. And then when it became possible, I moved down here in 74. I think I was at, it was after high school, but I'd had, I had a brother 2 years older, and he left the house to go off to, start his career. And then when I was a senior in high school, I lost a little brother to cancer. And so I didn't want my family to go from, three sons to none at home in a short period of time. So I stayed and went to a junior college up there to kind of help this transition with my family, and then moved out here in 74.
And what was that like? What did you do?
What did I do in Austin?
Yeah.
I came down to go to school.
Okay.
And of course the extracurricular stuff, took a lot of my time.
Sure.
Because it was so much fun, with Barton Springs, and which is a spring-fed swimming hole right in the middle of downtown, which attracted a lot of people. And then the music scene was just nuts. The only time my name would ever be mentioned in the same sentence as Stevie Ray Vaughan and Eric Johnson is that we were all three born within 6 weeks of each other. So, same age. You could go out at night and see a teenage Eric Johnson and a teenage Stevie Ray, and just, kind of mind blowing. Eric, to me, was as phenomenal then, at my age and perspective, as he is now. And he had a band called the Electromagnets, and it was just stupefying, what he was doing and the guys he was playing with were doing. And then, of course, Stevie Ray was here, and his older brother. And they had bands, I think, I can't remember the band that Jimmy was first in when I came down. Stevie Ray was playing with a band called Paul Ray and the Cobras. Paul Ray was a R&B singer and was a DJ on the local NPR station here broadcasting the university campus. And Stevie played guitar, and then Jimmy, I can't remember the first band, but then, when the Thunderbirds happened, that was a big, big, big deal. But there was just so much going on musically and socially that was foreign to me, but I certainly got involved in it.
Sure.
Pretty heavily.
And are you meeting these guys, or are you just a fan at this point, trying to see as many shows as you can?
Well, fanboy, I guess, in those days. It turned out, decades later, Eric's mother and my mother lived in the same senior living center, so I would see Eric on Sunday afternoons when we would come to visit our mom.
Oh, my gosh.
And we became friends, sooner than that, but back in the 70s, I didn't really know him personally, but I would certainly sit at their feet on edges of stages and with my mouth open.
Yeah.
My jaws dropped.
So you're an outdoorsy, music-loving guy who's moved to Austin to go to college. What are you studying? What's your career trajectory?
Well, I had friends from East Texas, a lot of oil business up there, all the oil fields in East Texas and surrounding areas. And so a lot of the guys I knew ended up going into these land management programs. They're called landmen, when they would, get leases and stuff for drillers and oil companies. And I was a geology major for a semester at UT and realized that probably wasn't really going to be my thing, the oil business. And then I was a business major for a short while and didn't really feel like that was going to be a thing that interested me, at least in, at that age. So ended up moving out of Austin and changing schools to what was then called Southwest Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas, which is about 30 miles down the interstate from Austin, a much smaller school, had this beautiful little, also Springstead River right in downtown, which and you could swim in. So became known in later years as the Valley of Flesh because all the college students would hang out on the riverbanks right downtown. And it's just a really fun and cool place to be at that age, at that time.
Yeah.
But between moving Austin, so when I moved out of Austin, going to change schools, for a while I lived in a school bus out in what's called Driftwood, Texas, which sounds like it would be on the beach, but it's not. and with a guy who had a printing press and was printing all the posters for the Armadillo. So we would get to go into the Armadillo World Headquarters all the time and see shows and stuff. And that gentleman, later on and for years, prints the labels for the Collings, our Collings guitar labels.
Wow.
In the small world department. Yeah.
Now I used to have a letterpress. How did he get it in the bus?
Well, he didn't have that in the bus. Oh, okay. He had a little print shop.
Okay.
This was an interesting guy. He'd built a geodesic dome where the top five sections, this pentagonal shape, he could flip a switch and they would open up with pulleys and cables into the heavens. And he blasted on his property, he had this arroyo, this kind of big ditch, and he blasted with dynamite into the limestone wall of this thing back about 40 feet and then built a little room that, you know, water filtering down through the limestone created this crystalline clear pool. And this, I mean, he was an amazing guy. And that was a brief period out there. And then I moved into San Marcos. And then later on, I moved out to Wimberley, Texas, which where I kind of spent my entire 20s, which was an amazing experience, too.
Yeah. So I think reading between the lines, we can assume you were a hippie.
Well, I was somewhat free-spirited, yes.
Okay.
So this place in Wimberley, I have to say, it's it was kind of a goat ranching area and a little tourist area because it is built around the Blanco or Blanco River, and I was fortunate enough to find a cabin. It was part of an old thing called Scotty's Camp in the forest. So it was used as a tourist area because of the river. So tourists would come from, you know, Houston, Dallas, whatever, and there were little camps and stuff around because it's a really beautiful little community on the edge of the Texas Hill Country. And I was able to rent this cabin, part of one of the old summer camp cabins, for $125 a month for 10 years. So my entire 20s, I lived on this riverbank on a dead end road in this little stone cottage. And then I would, from there, going to Austin, you know, several times a week and see music and stuff still. But it was just a really delightful and perfect place to spend your 20s. And of course, we had guys, you know, playing music out there, too. And it was met my wife out there, really a magical time for me.
Wow. When did you and Bill Collings first cross paths?
On those, one of the bands I would go in to see, well, actually the first time I met him, I was doing I was also a stonemason. Not only before trees, it was rocks. And I was doing a rock job. And my partner at that time ended up going to architecture school and designed Bill Collings' house. Another small world thing. But
yeah.
In 1980, Bill moved up from Houston. He had moved from Ohio down to Houston in the mid 75, I believe. Spent a few years there, which he really kind of got started, you know, in his guitar building career. And he had moved to Houston in 1980. And I was doing a rock job for a kind of a ranch entrance outside of it was way out in the middle of nowhere sort of at that time. And Bill showed up one day with Tom Ellis, Tom Ellis was a mandolin builder. You probably have talked to him before.
Yeah,
also has a company called Precision Pearl Inlay and does inlay work for, you know, most of the guitar companies. And Tom had some property out near there. So he showed up one day with this guy who I'd heard about, Bill. And they came out to this rock job, and that's where we first met. And then I was going into Austin a lot in those days, driving at night to see a band called Uncle Walt's Band. And Bill was also familiar with those guys and built an archtop guitar for the singer Walter Hyatt. And And so we became friends also through Uncle Walt's band. So that's when we kind of became closer friends, because I was coming into Austin a lot. And we were hanging out. And when I moved back into Austin after my 10 years on the river in 84, 85, we became closer friends and would like go to the gym together and, you know, do all kinds of stuff. And just became buddies.
Nice. And were you pretty happy as a stonemason?
I did like doing that. Obviously I like doing stuff outside. I like being creative, and the guy I worked with, in the 80s, the guy who went back to, you know, architecture school and became a designer, and we got to do some really cool stuff. And we worked for Willie Nelson's house up above Lubbock, Texas.
Nice.
You know about Lubbock and Lubbock Reunion and stuff.
Yeah.
We built this big house up on a hilltop, and we did a lot of stonework up there. And then we got to do work for the heiress to the Morton Salt family, and this really cool place out next door to LBJ's Ranch out west of Austin. So we got to do some really neat stuff. So I really did enjoy that life as well. But in 80, whenever it was, 80, I can't remember exactly. Things are kind of fuzzy from back then. But I was offered a job. Whole Foods was opening up their first restaurant outside of an in-store restaurant. It was a standalone restaurant owned by Whole Foods. And so I moved into Austin and was manager for this restaurant experiment for those guys. And got me back into town.
Now, is this just all through the Austin music community? Because why were they hiring a stonemason to manage a restaurant? Or was this just the laid-back style of Austin back in the day?
It was kind of that. I mean, speaking of laid-back, the guys that were running Whole Foods at the time, they had, prior to becoming Whole Foods, they had three guys kind of combined these two businesses to create Whole Foods. John Mackey, who's still, I think he's still the CEO, had a place called Safer Way. There was a big grocery store chain down here called Safeway.
Of course. It's everywhere.
So he had a store called Safer Way, and they had a great salad bar, and you could go eat, you know, brunch and breakfast and lunch and dinner through all this amazing kind of food bar. And they also had a little health food grocery store downstairs. And two other guys had a place called Clarksville Grocery. It had been two or three different things over the years. It had been a food co-op, and then I think they had the Clarksville National Grocery. And those three guys teamed up and started Whole Foods.
Wild.
And then at some point, and they had a restaurant, you know, in the store, the main store downtown on Lamar and 9th Street. And then they set up a place out south to be a standalone restaurant. And one of the guys who was involved in Whole Foods said, "He would be great at this." And I'm like, "Really?" So I moved into town. I did some tile work on the front of the store. The restaurant was called Wildflowers. And so they had someone hand paint this pastoral scene with a bunch of wildflowers. And I set those tiles on the front of the building for the restaurant, and then went to work inside.
Do they still exist? The tiles?
No, they took that down. Oh. That restaurant didn't make it all that long. And a Chinese restaurant moved in and got rid of that. And that Chinese restaurant's still there, you know, 30 years later, 35 years later, all 30 right. something years later. But in that restaurant, so they did a lot of nice woodwork inside in the bar, building the bar and all the booths and stuff. And that's where I met Bruce Van Wart, who's currently the longest tenured Collings Guitars employee. Bruce is a carpenter and was building the bar and stuff in the restaurant. So I met Bruce there too, you know, in those earlier years before the guitar. I was in the guitar business.
Yeah, incredible. Bruce has been on this podcast. It was a great episode. We actually got to see him in person, which was a rarity, which I loved. He took a trip up here. But so what happens after the restaurant with you?
Well, the restaurant was sold to an attorney. And the attorney realized that, hey, this guy works really hard and doesn't require much money or is working for not much money. So he said, "Come work at my law firm."
Okay.
And I was, well, sure. I thought about law school after, you know, being out of college for a few years and just kind of as a curiosity almost. But after doing paralegal work for a couple years at this law firm, I decided that wasn't going to be for me either. So I worked there for, a couple of years maybe, and then was offered a job as a project manager with what was called Cellular One, one of the early cell phone companies, which grew out of a family called McCaw Cellular, McCaw Communications, out of your area.
They've done well for themselves. Yes.
I think he was in late 80s was the highest paid executive in the country. As a teenager, I think the family, they made their money in the television cable business.
Yeah.
And as a teenager, he saw some report from AT&T about cellular industry. He started buying up licenses for future cellular for like $4-$5 a share, a license or something like that. And ended up later when he, outbid, I think, the Bell companies, and for these licenses, he was selling for like $350 a piece. So he made billions of dollars. And when I left there to go join Collings, it was when AT&T bought the first third of it. And then a couple of years later, they bought AT&T Wireless, bought the whole thing. And McCall's ended up doing really well. And I, when I left there to go do this guitar thing with Bill and the seven guys, I think they were working the company at that time, my dad was like, what? I had a company car and an expense account. And
what were you doing for them, actually, the cell company?
I was a project manager for Texas and Louisiana. So I was in charge of expansion, getting cell sites built, the equipment, the little rooms you see around, you used to see around, they're still around, these little equipment huts with all the radios and then the towers erected and the cables run, the antennas hung, and all the equipment installed in the equipment huts. And I'll remember to this day signing my first PO for more than $1 million and having my signature on it and thinking, uh-oh, I hope I'm protected by the company if something goes wrong. So did that for a short while, and then Bill had the Collings going and needed someone to kind of take over the front end of that business. And so I left there in 92 and went to work for Collings and been there ever since.
Now, had you and Bill just been in touch this whole time because of seeing bands and just Austin, or did he kind of reach out to you out of the blue?
Well, we were friends. We were kind of running buddies, it wasn't my best friend there, but we were close friends. Like I said, we would go to the gym together and go out and see Uncle Walt's band together. It was fun to go fishing together. He liked to bass fish, and there were a couple of musicians in town that knew these great little spots to go fishing. So we'd go fishing, and so it was just kind of fairly hedonistic days, but we were pretty close friends. And then out of the blue is when he kind of called up and wanted to have me come out to the shop.
And I was going to ask, so, you're on the road building cell phone towers and whatever they're called. are you hanging out much at the Collings shop, or is that like a home away from home for you, or you hadn't seen what you were getting into?
No, I had been there at that time. It was a little shop. He'd had several places in town. When he first moved up from Houston, he shared a shop with Tom Ellis, and because he was doing repair work, a lot of repair work. And then he shared shops with Mike Stevens, who went on to run the Fender Custom Shop. Sure. Years later, came and worked for us for a little while. And then for many years now, Michael Stevens has been, and I'm sure you've heard of Stevens Guitars, has been out in West Texas, where he's been for a long time.
Cowboy doing, poet.
He's a cowboy. He's a cowboy, all right. And has been a wonderful guy. I really liked him when he worked for us, and I really enjoy our friendship. And he's a great, great artist. And you see a picture of him, it looks like, he would have been in the Westerns movies, really cool guy. Great guy.
So what were the first tasks at hand when you got to Collings? Was it running well? Was there a long list of stuff you had to tackle?
Well, it was a small shop. I think there were seven people. including Bruce and a couple of other guys that had that worked with us for 15 to 20 years. They're no longer with us, but they're still doing some guitar work in town. So I just run the whole front end. There had been a guy there before, but he had was kind of doing everything on ledgers, and believe it or not, and the people I work with would be shocked to learn that I kind of set up the books on computer. I'm not a real tech savvy, I'm not a tech wizard, but on the telephone with the CPA, I got it all done over a period of time. So we actually had books that were an accounting system. There was an order list that was floor to ceiling, about 8 foot long, printed out, single space, dot matrix printed out, list of orders, and these cardboard production cards that we still use, something very similar today, that travel around through the shop, with guitars. Things are certainly much more, way more advanced than they were at that time. But I did the phones, I did sales, I did customer service, and just did kind of all the front end work. And then we started hiring people hire an in-house accounting person, and then, hired a couple of guys to do phones and sales. And, Alex is one of those guys who's still with us too, come back then. And I don't remember exactly what year he started, but it's been quite a while back. And then slowly hired people as the shop grew. We needed more people up front as well. So it was kind of an organic process.
It dawns on me that nowadays, because of friendships and conventions and Fretboard Journal videos and whatever, you can kind of see how other manufacturers have built up to where they are today, however big they are. At this point in time, were you kind of winging it, or had Bill gone to Nazareth and seen how Martin did it and thought, maybe we can do some of this? Was there much of a community, or were you just kind of like throwing stuff against the wall?
Well, there was a community back then, and Bill and Bob Taylor were good friends up until Bill's passing. And Bill did go to Martin some. I don't know that he'd been much by the early 90s, but certainly in the 90s would go up there. I think he actually got run off one time. I think Michael Dresner, if you know Michael,
yeah,
was showing Bill around and stuff. I think they said, get him out of here. What's that guy do? I was talking to Chris one time, Chris Martin. And he said he first met Bill at a guitar show somewhere. I don't remember which show it was. And he said, so I walk over, I'm looking at the guitars, and this little character kind of stands up and says, hi. And Chris says, yeah, I'm Chris Martin. And he said, Bill said, I know who you are. And Chris said, well, thanks for not copying my logo or something like that, because, he was certainly building, like most of the other guys at that time, dreadnoughts and kind of stuff that was tributing, Martin guitars from the previous 100 years. That's kind of a funny story when Chris tells it. But as a tribute kind of to Bill, and as a certainly a nod to Chris Martin, that all those many years later after Bill died, it was Chris Martin's idea to set up the NAMM Foundation as a fund under Bill's name to raise money for music education guitar education. It had to be related to guitar stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really, really sweet and spoke volumes of, I think, some of the respect people had for Bill, even though he might have driven him nuts in the previous decades. I thought it was a really neat thing for Chris to do.
Did Bill drive you nuts? Because Bill had this larger-than-life personality, and it, of course, translated to the shop floor, I'm sure, and your offices. He also was a perfectionist and this amazing creative thinker. But how did you get through all these years with Bill, working alongside Bill?
Well, interesting question. And yeah, he was really intense. He was an incredibly creative and talented person. I mean, unlike, I will never meet anyone else quite like Bill. There's certainly creative and talented people out there, but the drive he had and this kind of singularity, this focus, his family were engineers. People may know this. His grandfather, I think, had 69 patents through Dow Chemical. His grandfather's uncle was one of the guys who put America on wheels. He immigrated from Scotland and in the 1800s and was a bicycle builder, and then started building a quadricycle, you know, four wheels, and then putting motors on them. Kind of the same era as Henry Ford doing stuff. And the two actually raced each other in 1901, I think, early 1900s. So really, I think the first car sold commercially in the United States was a Winton automobile. That was Bill's great uncle, Alexander Winton. And so Bill had all that stuff in his DNA, and it was just kind of flowed down through him. And he also, though, had this amazing, he was a real artist, a real craftsman, a real engineer, and a real pain at times to work with, but it was always toward good. I mean, you would argue he was generally right, and what he did obviously impacted and affected people, because people started buying the guitars and realized that there was something special with what he was doing. And so I was there originally just to kind of, you know, run the front end and help him, because he didn't really at that point like dealing with people all that much. He'd rather be back in the shop. So he was back there and I was up front. It was a smaller, way smaller shop at that point. But in 91, he bought a little building outside of Austin, not far from where our shop is now. So after having the shops with Ellis and with Michael Stevens, He moved into a house kind of north central Austin. There was a little one car frame garage, and that was his shop. Became his shop. And then from there, he moved to another shop downtown. And then from there, we moved outside of Austin to the shop where most everything happened for 15 years before we moved to our current shop in 2006. So it was a small building. He was very much in charge and had great crew, and he and I, you know, over the years, there was a little bit of love hate going on, but we both were contributing to, you know, what was happening and where college was going, and I think he needed me to do for certain parts of that time, and I needed, of course, the company needed him to do his function, which was, you know, the vision and the quality. And he could build a guitar by himself and had been doing that, but he always wanted to kind of have a production style guitar built, but to the same quality that he could do by himself. And that was kind of his goal and his mission, really.
It's amazing.
Which is shown in the guitar labels, which if you look inside a college guitar in the sound hall, you'll see a label of kind of a mountainous region and a smoke belching mill and logs and guitars floating down river from this mill. And so he wanted that production and art industry kind of combination. He wanted to have a group of people do this, and that's what he did.
I'm going to get back to the timeline here, but what is the story with that label? Because it's one of those iconic, it's like looking at a can of Coors, like you're like, where is this thing? Who designed that label?
You know, I came across this after Bill died. And for a long time, people kind of ask, you know, where did that come from? In the 80s, he had this label that was it was just kind of a little stream with some flowers on the side and some tufts of grass and stuff. And it said Bill Collings Luthier. I don't know exactly what year it changed to the current label. And I did find somewhere in the last 3 years, like going through stuff after Bill died, and I found some documentation who did that. And I've looked for it kind of briefly a couple of times in the last year or two. I've got to find that again. I can't remember the person's name, but I'm glad you reminded me of that. I will need to kind of go back and dig through, because I was going through all kinds of stuff after Bill died. We were looking for pictures and all, you know, a lot of things. And I need to find that, because people do ask that. And I would like to give this person credit that people want to know who that was. So thanks for reminding me of that.
And we should add, because in case anyone out there wasn't lucky enough to ever cross paths with Bill, One of the great senses of humor in the world of guitar making, which is kind of a rarity. A lot of earnest luthiers out there, and Bill was downright hilarious. So I'm sure there was pro and con to that, but yes.
He was one of the funniest guys ever. I mean, just, you know, sometimes inappropriate, and sometimes just, you know, he was kind of this terminal 12-year-old. He just had, you know, potty humor and just funny, the things he would do, the stunts, people have heard the story of him. He killed a copperhead at his house. He brought it into the shop. He climbed up in this mezzanine kind of, that's where we have a bunch of the HVAC equipment, mm-hmm. which is kind of open to the floor below. And he brought a rod and reel and this dead snake and lowered it down while a guy was sanding and buffing a mandolin in one of the rooms that you could see from this mezzanine. And he lowered it down to touch his shoulder. And the guy, of course, freaked and tossed the mandolin. And he just guffawed as you know, hard as he could. And he liked to catch scorpions in the shop and cut the stingers off and then throw them on people. And
Among your many hats, were you also the HR person at this point?
I was kind of everything for a while.
Did you build guitars? Did you have anything to do with actually like putting them together?
At the tail end of the process, I would clean, polish, you know, check setups and string up and install pick guards, and, you know, use the buffing wheels and stuff, but I was never in the build. I could use, you know, a chainsaw and a circular saw and a hammer back in those days, but I was nowhere close to that kind of detailed work that was required.
Sure.
My capability.
You guys build these days, we'll talk about COVID in a minute, but you build so much. You've got flat tops, arch tops, mandolins, electric guitars, and then the whole Waterloo line, and you've done ukes and you've done cases. Give me a little bit of the timeline of when you started, what were you primarily building and kind of what came next?
Well, I started in 92 again. Mm-hmm. It was all flat tops.
Yeah.
Flat tops and a few arch tops. He'd been building arch tops since the early 80s. Like I have a round hole 16-inch arch top from 83.
Wow.
That I found at a used guitar store in Austin. Someone called me up and said, oh, there were some people visiting, there were tourists visiting the shop, and they said they had just seen an old Collings arch top, down at this used guitar store downtown Austin. And I said, oh, really? And I said, hey, can you show these folks around? So I called my wife, said, honey, I'm going downtown, fixing to put something on the credit card. And I drove downtown and bought this guitar, put it on the credit card, and came back to work. And I still have that guitar. Matter of fact, we used the logo on that guitar, this previous kind of handmade Collings inlaid logo, for the logo on the Julian Lage model guitar.
Nice.
Because I had it in the closet at the shop. That guitar. So, where'd I get off? Oh, so we're building flat tops and a few arch tops. And then I think 99 was mandolins, and he had, you know, he'd done arch tops since the 80s, always liked carving wood. He loved surfaces. And so I think mandolins was, to him, just an extension. He really liked carving wood. And so we got into mandolins. And then next would have been electric guitars in 2000. We started those in 2005 and first showed them at the Winter NAMM show in January of 2006. And then Waterloo's was 2014, I think. Ukuleles were somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. Maybe right before or right. I think right. I can't remember exactly, but ukuleles were on fire. You remember the trade shows, and all of a sudden everybody was building ukuleles.
Yeah.
And so Bill said, well, we could do that. And so we started building ukes, and we did that for a couple of years and realized we were just spread a little too thin because we also had Waterloos. And so we stopped. We had built a couple of batches. We still are finishing up a batch of ukuleles. We still had parts, and we still had orders when we stopped building them. So we're completing some of those and, which they're fun. They're such fun and cool instruments. I wish we could still do it all, but we can't. But yeah, and then cases which were around for a few short years and became too expensive to build.
And it's been a few years since I've been to your shop. Do folks who work there work on all these things, or do they kind of specialize in, I'm the mandolin fret guy or gal, or how do you divide that up?
Well, we do have a mandolin department.
Mm-hmm.
And there's guys that will just do that, just do mandolins. The electric guys just do electric stuff, whether it's build, finish, setup. The acoustic guys are now, the acoustic guitar people are also building the few Waterloos that we're doing. We've had to, and we'll talk about COVID in a minute, but post-COVID we have a reduced staff, and Waterloos had its own crew, but now we're having the acoustic guys building just a few Waterloos every month to keep that going. But until we can get back to whatever normal is going to be, and after we, it's going to take us, you know, I think 6 months, 10 months, maybe a year to kind of see where all the COVID stuff goes, and we can start putting back a fuller crew.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, between politics and COVID, which are obviously intertwined, there's a lot going on this year.
It's been a very stressful year for, you know, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. You must be talking to other, I mean, you talked about Martin, but you must be talking to other builders, large and small, and just gauging how they're doing all the time too, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we don't stay in touch, you know, on a weekly basis, but certainly during March when this was all happening, I was talking to, you know, a lot of people, and March 6th when they decided to cancel South by Southwest, which is a huge thing, brings in hundreds of millions of dollars to the Austin economy, because people from all over the world come. You know, the hotels and restaurants, the venues, it's a big deal. Have you ever been out to a South by Southwest?
I have, back in the day. I'm a little scared by how big they've gotten since they've added films and technology and all that stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, it got huge. And so to cancel it was a really big deal, because as you remember even back then, you know, companies like Google and Spotify and these huge companies would rent out buildings and have, you know, week-long parties and events and stuff. And it's a huge deal. So the cancel was a big deal, but obviously the right thing to do. So the week after they canceled that was the spring break week, started March 14th here for, you know, the University of Texas and a lot of the local schools was spring break week. So we decided, we don't normally close down for spring break, but we decided to close down and start kind of looking at what was happening around the country. And before that week was over, I think New York, Illinois, California had all shut down. And so we were looking at, and we didn't get officially closed down till the following week, the 24th. So we came back to work. So we closed down the week of spring break, the 14th, and came back to work on the 21st. But things were starting to happen around the country. And by Thursday, we were officially shut down. We were looking at, trying to figure out what is going to happen and looking at furloughs and stuff. And I was on the phone with the guys at Taylor that same day. They were doing the exact same thing, because California closed down, I think, the day before Texas, before Austin did. I think New York, Illinois, California, I think those are the first three states, and we were, you know, pretty close thereafter. But we were having to go, you know, what is going on and what is going to go on? Mm-hmm. Fortunately, the state of Texas had a mass claims program through the unemployment. So you could enlist a whole group of employees or sign up a whole group of employees still as employees onto this mass claims program through the unemployment commission through Texas, state of Texas, to get benefits, but still be, you know, rehirable easily enough without having to go through, you know, a person doing it individually, a single claim person, which you heard all the nightmare stories and still hear about people unable to get in touch with unemployment offices in various states. So that part was fortunate for the people that got furloughed. But that first week or two was, you know, anybody's guess as to what was going to happen.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking about, I mean, I want to talk about what you guys make as well more, but I imagine when somebody graduates from Roberto Venn or however people get where they get hired from, like there must be some serious training that goes on before anyone's kind of working autonomously on the callings line, right?
Yes, there is. And we always have some Roberto Vin students. There was a period of time, Bill Eaton, who was one of the founders of Roberto Vin, was at the shop a number of years ago. He's been out a few times. And at one point, almost 25% of our staff had been former, whether it was 2 years ago or 20 years ago, had been former Roberto Vin students.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool, because there's not that many places around the country. I mean, there are other schools. You know, Brian Gallup's got a school, and we hired people from the Red Wing, the technical college up in Red Wing, Minnesota,
sure,
to have a string instrument program and a good finish program. And those are more of like 1 and 2 year programs, whereas Roberto Vin is a 6 month program, 5 to 6 month program, which obviously you can't teach someone to be a craftsman in that period of time, but it's a really valuable thing for finding out if someone, you know, is a good learner, takes care of their tools, shows up to school, all those kind of things that are very tangible things. Of course, you know, has some hands, has an ethic. So those are really, really, really valuable things to know about a potential employee.
Yeah. I mean, you've had to invest so much in all these people. When somebody gets hired from one of these schools, or you have brought on a new employee, do you put them someplace first, or is it like, oh, we need somebody on the mandolin line?
It depends on kind of what the need is, but a lot of times we'll come in and put them in the buffing room. Just again, not every situation, but that's a common thing, because you're handling guitars, you're learning how to not, you know, accidentally bump something. You can't, I mean, it's, you know, the further along you get in the production process, if something goes weird, you're further back it's got to go to get fixed. But the buffing room seems to be an area where you can find out if they've got hands, because they're using sanding blocks, they're doing tasks that are repeatable, so they can learn faster than at some of the jobs. We do have pads on the floors around the buffing wheels for the inevitability when someone's learning and the buffing wheel catches the sound hole or the edge of a guitar and kind of takes it out of your hands. We have had them bounce up back into someone's hands, and we've had them bounce off the side and get a crunch, and then they go, you know, go to the bandsaw. But the training process you mentioned earlier is it takes about a year for someone to kind of learn about their job and to get good at it, and about 2 years to get, you know, to get good at what they're doing. And they generally stay in the same area for that couple of year period. Later on, we may move them around, or they may get moved depending on their interest and the needs, you know, in the shop at the time. But it's a pretty daunting, because it's not a natural thing to take wood and make it look like, you know, polished glass, and also, perform, and, you know, neck sets be right and all that stuff, and frets get seated properly. So it's a big learning curve for pretty much anyone that comes in.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I hope you can bring all those people back. Obviously you do too. Can you talk, I mean, when I interviewed Bill, he had this, what was it called? Bilgebra.
He had his own math.
He had his own math. And so he was able to do a lot of things that, perhaps more prudent and less fun-loving people wouldn't have done. You guys added all of these different products to your lineup. I'm curious, you were there for all of these, or aside from the flat top launch, when he wanted to build mandolins or ukuleles or Waterloo or even electrics, what was the process like of brainstorming, figuring out what the models were going to look like? Were you guys buying old instruments to kind of tear apart? I mean, just talk to me about where the ideas came from.
Well, there was, you know, generally with mandolins and with electric guitars and I think ukuleles, there was some interest in the shop, you know, other than just him, that wanted to do these things. But he was generally the driver of those things. And may have been a little mania involved with getting so many things going, mm-hmm, you know, at one time. It was basically, if he wanted to do it, we would do it. There wasn't really, you know, market research done, you know, ahead of time, but he had a knack for knowing that we could do something and how to do it. And then, you know, the whether or not you should was never really a consideration. I mean, everything worked. It was just generally the reason something would stop working is because we just had more than we could. You know, our hands were so full, we just couldn't really take on anything else or continue with some of the stuff because it just took, you know, the labor and what we do is probably, we probably have more labor than most other guitar companies because of his, you know, his no compromise kind of stance on things, even though over the years when I was on the inspection bench, he was like, you're going to inspect this out of business. You know, it was really, really funny the way he was about that in business, but also you're going to inspect this out of business, but you better not let that go. You know, don't let that out of shop. And at the same time, he'd say, no, let that, you know, it was just really funny. And that's any shop anywhere. You know, we still work with that today. You know, where's that line of what's acceptable, what's not? And of course, everything is, you know, as good as you can. We try everything as good as you can get it. And the thing around the shop over the years has been, if it can be done better, it should be. And that's just kind of the way he was. He always was kind of a reimaginer of things and then building better mousetraps. And that's, you know, still what we work on doing every single day.
When it came to the Waterloo line, were you buying a bunch of those cheap guitars?
Didn't have to buy. We had people with collections that would send us stuff. We didn't have to buy a whole lot. We did buy a few things, but we would have people that would send us things and to study. And that's what we would do. We would look at things that would come in, and it wasn't like we would go X-ray or quite to that detail, but just listening, you know, measuring some things, and then reading historical, you know, information about them. And he, again, the engineer and the craftsman he was and designer he was, he just would get it. He just got a lot of things, and was able to pass that on, you know, and share that with the other guys in the shop and girls.
I mean, at the time of Bill's passing, you guys were doing not only everything that we talked about, but you were doing cases, and he had a car enterprise going on next door. Were there other Bill ideas brewing where you're like, oh God, here we go again, that we'll never see the light of day?
Not in the guitar world. And in the last, say, 10 years of his life, he got involved, and he's always been a car and motorcycle guy. Motorcycles from way back from his youth. Cars, I don't know where his love started, but he became, I don't know if you know what spec Miata racing is.
He was racing Miatas. I remember that.
He was racing Miatas, and it was really funny. It was spec Miata, so they weren't supposed to be altered, but all these guys the few that I knew of would kind of figure out these little sneaks and way to improve performance without being really altering the car. And so they would do these 24-hour Le Mans races instead of Le Mans races, where they would just, you know, all out around the track, I don't know how many times. And he just loved that stuff. They would haul cars all around the country and do these races. And he, of course, joined local racetracks so he could go there and race and run. He would take his, he always had a pensions for high performance vehicles. And so he'd have Porsches and BMWs, you know, not multiples of, but I mean, over the years, a Porsche or a BMW, and he would go race them on the track too. He just loved speed. He, you know, loved going fast. He liked the performance of what those cars would offer him, and just like performance with, you know, with guitars. And the last 5 years, probably, he really got into hot rods. And would bring in, he would buy bodies, he would buy chassis, he would buy motors, and he spent most of his time on one particular vehicle, a 31 Ford, and spent years and, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in this car because it was going to be his, you know, his calling card for future work. And it was an immaculately beautiful car. The all the time and months he spent, like things like the louvers on the hood and the panel underneath on the back of the guitar that covered the gas tank. You would never see it unless you laid down, but they spent months on sanding and painting the louvers on this piece that you didn't even see. That was just kind of how he was, you know, the detail-oriented person that he was. And a lot of the door latches inside were little push-button latches, and they were shaped like the logo for that business, Collins Custom Craft, was kind of shaped like a headstock on a guitar. And so there were these grained ivory push buttons in the shape of a guitar headstock looking thing for the opening and closing the doors. Yeah, just unbelievable detail and design, and just would put whatever into it that it took to make something the way he wanted it.
Has that vehicle gone on to a new home?
Yeah, the guy that was, that belonged to a person, so he was paying all along to get this car. He sold it when it was done because he said that was too much car for him. I think he was worried about the liability and something getting messed up and who was going to fix it if Bill wasn't here. So he sold it to a guy or a company who was in the hot rod business. It didn't sell for near as much as was in it, but again, that was going to be Bill. That was Bill's advertising with this car. And they won awards. He would travel around the country, haul it around, and they would go to guitar shows, and he would win awards. And it was in, Rodder's magazine. He really was into that stuff too.
Crazy.
So that started out back in the warehouse. That started in the warehouse of our shop, and then over the last, 6 or 7 years, he built some other buildings on the front of the property, and then moved his car shop down there. So he had his, standalone, nice automotive shop where he could spend a lot of his time down there and still come up to the guitar shop. It was just to walk up the hill to the guitar shop. So he got to do his two favorite things. And he would learn about guitars from working on cars. He would learn about cars from working on guitars. I mean, as far as, he would always like shapes and surfaces. And he was really, again, a true artist and designer in that sense.
Yeah. Incredible. So where are things
incredible
at?
Is a good word.
Yeah. I miss him every day. I miss coming to NAMM, and what was it, on Friday mornings? NAMM starts on Thursday. Friday morning, he would walk in with a guitar that he had finished that morning and jumped on a plane and it was still wet, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. He would decide in December of something he wanted to do. And it would arrive smelling like lacquer. We'd have to open the cases up and let it, he was time management, maybe not one of his greatest skills. But the proof was always in the pudding. What you got was always an amazing result from what he, either did himself or put in motion. And then, the guys in the shop would just take over. But yeah, that was pretty common to start something really late. in the NAMM, scope of NAMM, time frame, and then we would end up having to carry stuff on the plane. Yes, and in the later years of his life, he would also maybe leave NAMM and go visit hot rod shops in Southern California.
Oh, cool!
So he got to still kind of work with both of his passions, and NAMM being out there in Southern California, he wouldn't have to go too far. The guys that had worked on his old truck or his current projects, and guys that were doing the same thing out there. So we like to mix the two activities.
There's always been that guitar car connection from back when Fender was using paint codes to Jimmy Vaughn and all points in between. It's kind of funny.
It is funny. And we actually tried a few art guitars over the years and had an artist who did a lot of work on cars and gas tanks on motorcycles and did a few painted guitars, but it turned out not to really be our thing. Our customers didn't really want guitars with hot rods painted on them or racing stripes and stuff like that. So
you guys are too classy for that. Yeah.
Well, these are classy paint jobs. Don't get me wrong, but yes, it didn't really fit with what we were, known for.
Let's talk a little bit about 2020. I mean, you guys have been making exceptional instruments for decades, and we love everything that you do. I don't think you know this, but for 15 years of the Fretboard Journal, whenever we question ourselves about should we run a story or not, the internal dialogue that I have is always like, would a typical Callings owner want to read about this, whether or not it's Callings related or not? But I've said that for 15 years now. I just said it with Michael Simmons back in the day, and I continue to say it. But where are you at right now with COVID? And I mean, the shop is running, right? A little bit?
Oh, yeah. And thank you for that comment. That's really sweet of you. And we do have discerning customers. So yeah, that's a good thing to consider. But thanks for sharing that.
Of course.
So again, we were, shelter in place, whatever the one was here for Travis County, Austin, where the shop is. But on March 24th, we had to close down, and we were closed for 9 weeks. And I was talking during that time, I was talking to guys at Martin. I talked to Fred Green. I was talking to guys out at Taylor. I was meeting with the CFO and the finance people at Taylor about, we were looking at PPP stuff. We were, I was talking to Richard Hoover some, and we were just all in this same boat, and no one knew what was going to happen. And certainly no one expected, the guitar sales to do what they have done over the last number of months, but we really had no idea would guitars become the last thing on people's minds, which of course, when you think about it, it's like, well, of course they would be, because in a time like that, you need to create, you need something to bond with, and you need to be able to express yourself. So, but at the time we had no earthly idea. And so we were, our HR person, as a matter of fact, right after this happened and we were shut down, we had letters for the four of us. There was Ruth, who was the head of HR, and Clint, who's head of engineering, who you've probably met. Mm-hmm. Myself, and I think the head of production, come in. So we had letters with us saying that, some text from the order from the state and the county printed out that we were able to come in and kind of maintain operations. We had to keep the kiln going. We had to keep the AC, the climate control going. We had to, she got pulled over that morning saying, where are you going? By the, I don't know if it's the sheriff's, she was outside of Travis County Sheriff's Department or the DPS service to find out why she was outside her house, out on the roads, literally.
Wow.
Got pulled over and asked that. She presented this letter and they said, okay, you can go on in. So yeah, it was that serious, in the early weeks of this thing. And so there were a few of us going in and we were just like, my goodness, what's this going to look like? And so we were able to, we brought a few more people in. So the idea is, well, while we're closed down and with the current situation, we can get, two or three more people in here. So we worked on repairs, customer repairs and some repairs and production repairs, which was a perfect time to do that. There was nothing else going on in the shop. The shop is plenty big enough that having X number of people, there was no big deal as far as distancing at that point. The number of people, the tiny number of people that were coming in, and over the weeks, we could bring in a few more. But it was just, we did not know what was going to happen, and didn't until, weeks and weeks and weeks afterwards. So we did two rounds of furloughs and then have strategically bought people back. We came back to work on May 18th and have brought some people back, not the full crew. I'm still a little concerned about what's going to happen over the coming months and pulling people off unemployment, putting them back on unemployment. We just don't know.
Yeah.
So we stayed at a percentage of our former capacity with, demand being what it turned out being, which again, we weren't prepared for or weren't expecting. We were able to bring back a few more people and we'll continue to do that.
Yeah, I'm curious because, back in April, it seemed like the only wise investment would be like dried beans and hand sanitizer. We were all bringing groceries home and washing them and disinfecting the bags. And now we've learned a lot. And what also happened is everybody wanted a guitar and a bicycle, it seems. And those two industries obviously shut down and thought that, 2020 was going to be an awful year, but people ended up buying these instruments. So how do you gauge how far back you swing the other way and start trying to meet the demand?
Well, that's the challenge on everyone's plate. So when we started bringing some people back, we of course did all the protocols that were not only required but our duty to do. We had two shifts. Some guys come at 6 a.m. Some guys come in at 3:30. They don't cross, and we do disinfecting and stuff in between. We put up some plastic sheets in a few areas where people may be 6 feet apart, but not that much further apart. Mm-hmm. In some areas that, you know, whether it's just a walking area where people are going by. So we put up some big plexiglass stuff just to do. And of course we had stations at every, you can only come in one door of the shop and go out one door of the shop. And we had big stations at each of those doors, and by the bathrooms were hand sanitizers and wipes. And we would, you know, thermometer check, you know, all the stuff that needed to be done. And we're still doing, we still don't let a vendor in the building unless they make an appointment, and then we go through the questionnaire and we check temperature and stuff like that. We will warn all employees or notify all the employees. There'll be a contractor on site or, you know, whatever wow. the yes. case may be. So we've done all that stuff. To date, we had two positive cases, I think, back in May. Nothing since then, you know, knock on wood. So we did all that stuff right. But as far as, you know, how to know when and how far to push the gas pedal down is, we still don't, and we're just still being, you know, cautious because we want to protect the employees and their families and our customers. And, you know, it's been an interesting time, and we talked to a lot of our dealers. So one interesting thing and the way that we started handling, you know, production as we started coming back is that we contacted all the dealers. We found out which orders they either had deposits on or have been prepaid or, you know, customer's name on an order, and got them to get with the customer and found out what was truly a fillable order, something we could work on. And so we marked things, everything in the system as high priority, regular priority, or hold. From some stores, you know, again, didn't quite know what their immediate future was going to look like. So we were able to focus on which guitars we knew we could ship out when they were done. And so the second half of May and June, we're working on those things to make sure that the dealer could get paid when something got to them because they had money, you know, from a customer, or that we could get paid from the dealer because the revenue hit is, you know, pretty significant when you just get shut down. As anyone, you know, like I say, everyone can tell you. What's happened since then, of course, has been surprising. I know Fender has reported, you know, the biggest sales year ever. They're not all, you know, expensive guitars, and they've done a really amazing stuff over the last 10 years with all their online lessons and all kinds of stuff related to the consumer. So, you know, they had been working on these things for a number of years that certainly paid off post-COVID. But we're selling high-end guitars. The market's, of course, not as big as some of the products that those companies offer, the bigger companies offer, you know, price point and accessibility and stuff. But knock on wood, you know, we've been fortunate to be able to keep people, you know, X number of people here and keep working and keep our customers going, our dealers.
Yeah. I am curious, when you had that dialogue with those dealers, I mean, everything you do is high end, but was the overriding sentiment, we need to make these, you guys need to start making these, you know, gorgeous, super high end arch chops that are super rare, or were people wanting more of the entry level Waterloo stuff, or was it kind of scattered amongst the whole line?
Well, we don't build many arch tops.
Yeah.
You know, we just build a few a year, if that, you know, anywhere from one to four a year over the last probably 6 or 8 years, because it's just a, you know, it's a very labor intensive operation. And the guy who was working those, Aaron Huff, who you mentioned earlier, was one of the guys, you know, doing the majority of the assembly and work on those. Has been is the head of the electric guitar department, so he's had his hands full.
Yeah,
all the heads of departments have had their hands full, whether it's, you know, Bruce or Steve Nall or you know, Angela in sales. It's been a pretty crazy year, obviously, but we the dealers wanted just, you know, the standard Collings stuff. I mean, they wanted what we do, you know, whether it's traditional series acoustics or regular acoustics, or, you know, they wanted what we normally do, what they had on order, which is largely just our standard offerings. With the reduced staff, we've had to, they didn't want us to focus more on calling stuff and Waterloo stuff. There's more money in it for them, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's why the Waterloo line has gone down. And of course the lead time now for those is nuts, but they want us to focus on Collings instruments, and that's what we're doing.
Sure.
Mandolins, guitar, electric guitars.
At NAMM, I'm going to bring this to a post-COVID world. Hopefully there will be one. at NAMM, you had an electric guitar. You guys famously, there was that Tim O'Brien kind of Collings Nugget collaboration, but you famously, I think, never really aligned with, you never had signature model guitars in my memory, if memory serves. But Julian Lage has been this force of nature and a big Collings supporter over the years, and one of the true geniuses of the music world. How did that end up happening, that electric that I saw at NAMM?
Well, we started we did this project with Julian on the acoustic guitar side. He really liked, he's a, as you mentioned, an incredibly talented person and an incredibly humble and wonderful person, you know, a man of that talent. So just an amazing, amazing guy. And he was really, he liked what was happening with Waterloos and the traditional series we were doing, these kind of lighter builds and stuff. And he and our customer service guy, Mark Alpins, communicated a lot, as do most of our artists, you know, work with Mark, about doing something more specific to what Julian kind of had in his mind's ear, mm-hmm. mind's eye and mind's ear. And we started talking, and he has that 39 guitar that he, has played a long time, and the neck and the different things about it. And so he would started coming down the shop, and he and Bill, of course, hit it off because they were not normal people as far as their, understanding. And they would, how twins kind of have their own language, yep. children, and these guys could go off into these areas that would leave me kind of in the dust, obviously, from, because I'm not one of those, I'm just not one of those, but like Bill or Julian in really many aspects or any aspect. And so it became a project maybe a couple of years, and ended up with this Julian Lage model, which I was on the phone last night at 10 o'clock with someone asking me about these Julian models and the kind of the differences and what Julian plays. And, people have really responded to this thing. And it's been, it's just fun working with guys like that. And so he approached us a couple of years back about doing an electric guitar, because electric guitar companies were reaching out to Julian to do something. And he told us kind of what he wanted to do and what he wanted it to be like, and reference guitars that he was playing and wanted to do something like that. And so we started working on toward a guitar that would work for him. And we did have kind of a prototype last year at NAMM, and then the release would have happened earlier this year, but with COVID and he moved cross country, and this travel was kind of out of the question, and still nailing down all the specifics that he wanted. And so it's getting closer.
It's still getting dialed in.
That's becoming a real thing.
It's still getting dialed in, the specifics of it.
Yes. The whole COVID time delay of 6 months has not really helped anything, but it's close to dialed in. There'll be some marketing work done in the coming months, and then hopefully the world will get their hands on those sooner than later.
Yeah. The acoustic must be one of your better selling. I see it everywhere, I relatively speaking, I see it often. Is that one of your better selling models, the flat top?
It's done really well. Partially because of obviously who Julian is, but which gets people attracted to it and check it out. And once they play it, they're like, oh yeah. I mean, it feels really good. It's, you know, it sounds really good. He wanted to use that, what we call the vintage satin finish, which kind of opens things up just a little bit. It doesn't have that, you know, when you buff a lacquer guitar, kind of almost like this M&M kind of shell on it, you know, a little protective shell. Yeah. And when you have this satin, it kind of softens. It's like satin versus, you know, polished or glossy lacquer finishes on mandolins or anything else. The satin kind of has, it does have a different tone. And so all the different things that made the Julian, you know, the neck construction, all the things that made it different are things that appeal to a lot of players.
It's a beautiful guitar. And the electric in whatever iteration I saw was also really darn cool. And
there were people that, yeah, it was way cool. Yeah. There are people that are saying it's the best guitar, best electric guitar sound I've played. And again, the when it gets out in the public is when the real test will be, when we can get these out. And right now, trying to figure out how and when is what we've been working on, as well as nailing down all the final parts of it.
Yeah. There's no NAMM 2021, which I don't know. I'm okay with that. Sounds like the right thing to do. Are you guys at this point just trying to figure out what production looks like in 2020 and meet the existing demand, or are you still thinking about new models and stuff?
So, you know, it was the right call, obviously, to make, to cancel the show. Mm-hmm. Everyone's curious about what the virtual NAMM will look like. Last night ended IBMA 2020. It was virtual. Do you know what that is? I'm sure you do. The International Bluegrass Music Association.
I do know. I only saw that Will the Circle Be Unbroken. I have to admit, I did not tune in to any other IBMA coverage. Did you?
I did. I couldn't watch it all day every day, obviously, because, you know, I was working. But I saw quite a bit of stuff, and I was watching all the finale performances last night, the last night musical performances, which... it went off pretty well. NAMM is using the same platform, virtual platform that they use. So I think they can I hope they will look at that and get some feedback from either IBMA, things that they can help, because it was a really huge task for IBMA to do this. And so if NAMM's using the same platform, which they are, they'll be able to, you know, maybe learn some lessons or take some information away from IBMA that can help, because NAMM's going to be certainly a much bigger thing than IBMA. But I thought overall it went really well, considering they didn't have all that much time to try to do this. But I think it was I think it came off pretty good.
Not to get too industry insider, but you know, NAMM's a trade show. IBMA's kind of more performance based. So is the virtual NAMM going to be like a manufacturer buys an hour-long slot to talk about their wares, and it's streamed on a video?
Well, you'll have your personal, your company. Alex is doing this, so I'm not sure the right word. Not just use the word page, for example, where you can, with IBMA, and I'm not sure exactly what NAMM will look like. You had the ability to post one video, an ad, something fairly simple and minor. But you could, people could respond to your people that you had signed up to work the booth, basically, French in questions and stuff. So there wasn't a lot of interaction in our experience, with the manufacturer page on this platform. I'm not sure, again, if NAMM will be that same way or not, but we did a lot of stuff with social media outside of the IBMA thing that would, you know, in response to the, you know, artist demos and just artist videos they sent in and things like that. We're anxious to see how NAMM works. So yes, we are preparing for that. And this was a good little stepping stone to IBMA to work toward that. It hasn't been a great year to have time for developing new things, but we have some stuff that we've been working on that we'll see the light of day. Timing wise, it's kind of hard to say how it's all going to work, but possibly during NAMM, maybe some before, maybe some a little after, but there will be some new stuff. And then some, since we don't have a show to go to, we'll have some showcase models too, that will be posting videos and doing things about during NAMM. Because normally it's a show, you take your regular stuff that people look at, and you take a few, fancy things or special things that maybe not be new models, but just stuff to show and get some attention. So we'll have some things like that too, that we'll kind of showcase either through photography and videos for during the NAMM week.
I love it. You guys, your booth's always a little oasis at NAMM of good music and fun people, and hopefully the virtual version is the same.
Yeah, we hope so too. And it's certainly different. The NAMM, we had the good fortune to be downstairs in Hall E, which is certainly much quieter and much more civil for having conversations and hearing. You still can't hear acoustic guitars too well down there because the ambient noise is loud, but nowhere near upstairs. And, is it smarter business to maybe be upstairs? Maybe, but I think for our customers, our dealers, being able to come downstairs and talk and have, conversation is way, I think, more productive for us than being upstairs in the fray. So, yeah, we do miss seeing people, of course, for there and all our friends, you, for example, and all the people there, either other manufacturing friends or just customers or, you'll miss all that, which is a big part of what these shows are. But at least for me,
yeah.
But we'll, we can still talk. We can still, email and stuff with those guys. It's just, there'll be a very different experience this year, and I'm thinking it'll go fine. We'll find out in January.
Your guitars, you've got dealers everywhere. Was this run on guitars in 2020 during COVID, where everybody decided to take up an instrument or buy their dream instrument finally, and then there was sort of a lack of inventory? Was that an American or North American thing, or was that around the world people were trying to hoard guitars?
It's happened in other places as well. Our guys in the EU and the UK have expressed the exact same phenomenon. Of course, they're all pins and needles with Brexit happening in December 31st, so that's going to be a big deal for those markets on top of everything else. But they experienced the same kind of demand, which was, it's not a stretch to get it after the fact that, well, if I am at home and some people are working from home, and they're on their computers to look at guitar pictures and they go, I used to play guitar, I'm going to get back into it. Or, I'm stuck here, I'm going to upgrade, or I'm going to buy another guitar and I've got all this time on my hands. I can play more. So when you think about it, it wasn't that surprising, even though it was maybe unexpected. But and we'll just see if everyone keeps it up. That's the big question. And with our dealers too, it's like, how long will it continue? And at the same rate, and no one really knows that stuff either, which is again one of the reasons we're being cautious on how we approach, the months ahead. But yeah, it was a real surprise for everyone, and it seemed to be fairly worldwide. And some dealers more successful than others, at this, in the whole online world. If you were set up more for it already, if you had good inventory, if you had good photography, if you had those have been huge things, factors in which dealers have been more successful with this than maybe some that weren't quite as prepared for this.
Yeah, the stores that have invested in online over the years, and I know it's not cheap, especially now. We've even seen, obviously there are some dealers that are by appointment only who are saying we're not going to need 20 of the new Fretboard Journal. We're only going to need 5 because we only see 5 people a month or whatever. It's separated the big players from the indie guys who didn't want to be online. That's for sure.
Well, and the whole thing impacted the whole supply chain, which has been a big conversation too during this whole thing. So those first, weeks and months when before things went crazy, that the string people, case people, electronic people, wood people, all of them have felt this down to, again, to, like you say, publications. It's really been an unusual situation, you know, to put it mildly. I'm glad to see that people have, a lot of people have figured out how to cope with it. Even though there are plenty that haven't had that opportunity, that are unemployed, they're at home, but they're not working from home. So how that gets handled and how it's been handled and will continue, you know, get handled from here forward is a big question on everyone's minds. And it's obviously looming large and in the news currently.
Not to out any of your vendors, but is there any part? I mean, I know you guys have an incredible stockpile of wood, but are there any parts to guitars or mandolins that you just can't get right now, even if you wanted to build them?
We have not had too much trouble with that. I know some of the Chinese factories were closed down, obviously, for this. We don't have a lot of product that comes from China. Some of the supply houses had a problem with a few things, but we've been able to keep going. You know, some of the guys that rewind pickups may have had a few hiccups, but that seems to be fairly well worked out. So, and knock on wood, it's been extremely trying, but we've been able to, you know, move forward. So that's not at certainly the rate or the pace that we were before that we would like to be right now, but just, you know, there's three of us right now that are kind of the committee that are kind of running things and the steering committee. It's Clint, the head of engineering, and Ruth, the head of HR, and myself. And so we are just trying to figure out, you know, the best way to do things, you know, on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis. And it's, you know, certainly been challenging, but it's, we're still here and we're, you know, still progressing. Just not where we'd like to be, but where we're at, and
yeah,
you know, we'll figure it out as it get further into this.
Of course, yeah. One more question. I know a lot of people have wondered this, and if you, I can edit this out if you don't want me to include it. But what does the ownership of Collings look like? I think everybody was freaked out a few years ago that when Bill passed away, that somehow it would go somewhere else or disappear. Is it in a strong place right now? Does the family own it? And is it here to stay?
It's here to stay. His wife owns it. So that's the current situation. Bill's wife is the 100% owner. He was the sole owner. All the, you know, 100%, no one else had anything investor involved with it. Right now it's his wife. She's leaving it up to us to run things. There have been people reach out about interest in the company, which we are not at this point interested in doing that. You know, if she changes her mind over the years, we don't know what she's going to want to do, but right now that's the ownership and the operations, and for the foreseeable future, that's how it's going to be.
That's amazing. That's great. And final question, how are you doing? How are you? I mean, you got this shoulder rehabilitation. Are you working more than ever? Are you able to kind of take up transcendental meditation or baking or something to calm your nerves?
I often wonder what I'd do if I had the time. When I was sitting here for a couple of weeks, I think I took off 2.5 weeks of the shoulder. The doctor said, go back on this date. And that was about 2.5 weeks later. And I went a little, I mean, I couldn't do much because I was in this big sling and this contraption that held my arm immobile. And I was in pain for a few days after the surgery. And so I don't know that I don't do nothing very well. So I'm not sure. I don't know what I would. No, I'm working as much as ever. I go in a little late and I stay late. So it's, you know, I'm still in the 50 plus or minus a little bit hours a week, and then stuff at nights and weekends and when necessary, not as much now as before. But it's, no, I'm still doing as much as before and different directions. Some of it, as we, you know, we've always, all the people, pretty much everyone there, wears multiple hats. So we're still doing that, maybe even more so than before, in some situations, but that's, you know, small nature of smaller business, nature of our business for sure, and I'm okay with that.
It's great.
I don't mind working.
Steve, I know you didn't want to be on the podcast, but your story is like the guy who traded the paperclip for the ballpoint pen and then worked his way up to getting a house. Like, you started laying stone down and now you're helping helm one of the great guitar companies of the modern era. So it was a good story.
Well, I didn't know that you'd ask me to do this, and I just didn't know that my story would be that interesting. But I hope listeners find it okay. I appreciate your persistence in doing this, and you know, everyone loves what you do. The Fretboard Journal is the kind of pinnacle of, I mean, I get piles of guitar magazines and industry magazines on my desk, you know, on a daily basis, and I get through as many of them as I can. The Fretboard Journal is obviously a special magazine, and I always love seeing that, and the statement you made earlier about, well, the colleague's customer life, I love that as being one of your,
it's our mantra. Yeah. It has been for 15 years now and probably will be for another 15. It's just an easy way to frame things when you're thinking about, you know, is this music? It's out there, but is it too out there? What would a callings customer think? It's a nice way to frame things.
I like that, and I'm glad that's going to get shared with the listeners. And some people may take it different ways than others, but I think it's awesome. And I appreciate that. And appreciate you, buddy.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Go enjoy the rest of your weekend.